Every so often, on just one of those days, little bits of heaven crash into the Earth. They come from our own solar system, or millions of light years away. Few of us are ever lucky enough to get our hands on one of these space rocks, lumpy, dark, gray. They have, after all, left heaven. But meteorite hunters love them anyway. And NPR's Lauren Silverman met up with one meteorite hunter and brings us this story.
Ruben Garcia's license plate makes him easy to spot on a sunny morning in Tucson, Arizona.
Awesome. It says meteors on it.
Yeah, it does.
Our destination? An enormous dry lake bed a few hours south of the city. It's ideal for hunting meteorites.
A meteorite strikes the Earth about 1 per 1,000 years per square mile. The longer this dry lake bed has been here, exactly like this, the longer it's had time to accumulate meteorites.
The lake bed is a lunar landscape, about 50 square miles of flat, dusty, cracked earth. In the distance, it looks like there's water, but it's only a mirage. Ruben starts to drive in small circles, leaving tracks in the dirt with his tires.
What are you doing?
All right, so sometimes when you're out on a giant dry lake bed, the best way to hunt meteorites is from the seat of your Jeep.
Here's how you do it. Drive around until you see a dark rock, pull up beside it, and examine.
There's a black rock right here, and I'm just going to look and see real quick what it is. It's volcanic, and it's not a meteorite.
So we move on.
They fall whenever and wherever, but deserts preserve them well. Oceans and rainforests, those are meteorite graveyards.
Yeah, here's a rock that looks interesting. The problem with this one is I can see quartz right away in it, and meteorites never have quartz.
What is the quartz? Is the shiny?
Yeah, anything that you can see sort of sparkling. Meteorites don't sparkle.
We make it to the edge of the lake bed, a good place to find rocks, and hop out. Ruben's carrying a long golf club with a magnet glued to the bottom. He explains meteorites have a large percentage of nickel iron, and nickel iron will stick to a magnet.
So there's something that stuck to my magnet that is not man-made iron.
Ruben will have to take a closer look at it later, because a lot of regular rocks also stick to magnets. So how can you tell the trash from the treasure?
Does it have fusion crust? Does it have flow lines? Does it have remoglyphs?
That's all just physical evidence on the rock it has been through our atmosphere. This is tough work. For over 20 years, Ruben has traveled to places in the middle of nowhere and studied flecks, specks, and spots on thousands of rocks, all to find meteorites that are often the size of walnuts, and sometimes worth just as much.
If we find a meteorite out here today, and it's the size of a golf ball, and we really got aggressive marketing it, we might be able to buy lunch for all of us.
And we're talking fast food, not an 8-course meal. So why does he do it? Well, for each walnut, there is a diamond. Every now and again, something so special will fall from the sky that everyone wants a piece of it. That's what happened last July when 15 pounds of rock fell to Earth from Mars.
This meteorite is absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's almost as if it was knocked off Mars yesterday.
That's Caroline Smith. She's meteorite curator at the Natural History Museum in London.
It's so fresh and so pristine. It's arguably the most important meteorites who have landed in the last 100 years.
She got the biggest piece of the meteorite, but is coy about how much it cost.
I'm not going to give you numbers for that because we don't discuss the monetary value of meteorites.
Besides, Smith says the commercial value is irrelevant. The scientific value is far greater.
Even though the diamond may look nicer, the fact that you're holding something from Mars and something so rare and precious and so interesting beats diamond every time.
Ruben Garcia and I spent hours in the sun poking at rocks with golf clubs. And ultimately, we came up empty-handed. But this is what makes meteorite hunters feel connected to something bigger, something otherworldly.
I like to think that we play a big part in the whole space race. We give them extraterrestrial material to study, where without meteorite hunters, we would need a ship and a whole lot of fuel to go out and retrieve it.
Whether it's to study, display, or just hold for a little while, who wouldn't want their very own piece of the stars? Lauren Silverman, NPR News.
Standby. It's Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Guy Raz. Our cover story today is on the upcoming election in Russia, and we'll have that story in a moment. But first, oil giant BP has agreed to settle thousands of lawsuits stemming from its well blowout in the Gulf of Mexico. The deal was announced last night and prompted a New Orleans federal judge to postpone a Monday trial. But as NPR's Debbie Elliott reports, the proposed settlement solves only one piece of BP's legal exposure from the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history.
The settlement would cover only private plaintiffs, individuals and businesses with either economic losses or medical claims resulting from the oil spill. BP estimates it will pay out $7.8 billion to compensate oil spill victims, but there's no cap on claims. Plaintiff Chris Nelson of Bon Secours Fisheries, a seafood processor on the Alabama Gulf Coast, isn't yet sure whether the settlement will satisfy his family's claim for lost business, but he's somewhat disappointed the trial has been delayed.
You know, I understand court cases often settle, but I think that people kind of deserve to know what actually happened out there.
BP and what's known as the Plaintiff Steering Committee announced the framework of the agreement last night, but the terms have yet to be finalized. And that lack of detail is troubling for Daniel Becknell Jr., a lawyer in Reserve, Louisiana, who represents oil spill victims.
We don't know how long the claims process will take. We don't know the finite amount of money that is going to go to various types of plaintiffs because no claims data has been collected. We don't know exactly how long the process will take. Most of these people are going to have to start from ground zero.
The settlement must be approved by the court before it's official. But the fact that the parties have an agreement is significant, says Martin Davis, director of the Maritime Law Center at Tulane University in New Orleans.
It's a big step forward to final resolution of the private claims. It doesn't settle everything, though. It won't make the trial go away altogether. Or at least not just yet.
That's because BP still faces lawsuits from other companies involved in the well and from the federal and state governments. And billions more are at stake in civil and potential criminal fines for environmental damage caused when BP's well blew in 2010, killing 11 rig workers and spewing some 200 million gallons of oil into the Gulf. Alabama Attorney General Luther Strange is coordinating the claims from Gulf states against BP. He declines to discuss settlement negotiations. He says the states want to go to court.
We have a very strong case to make against BP and the other defendants. And so we look forward to trial. Of course, you know, if something happens on the settlement front, we'll have to review that at the appropriate time.
The Department of Justice says it's pleased BP may be stepping up to address harms to individuals, but says the deal by no means addresses the company's full responsibility. Alabama oysterman Chris Nelson hopes there will ultimately be a trial.
It was pretty traumatic for everyone, certainly not to the extent that it was for those families who lost loved ones, but all of us that suffered an impact from it, we want to achieve some kind of closure with it, and I don't think the money is going to be what people are really looking for here.
Debbie Elliott, NPR News.